Hello, I'm Stan Correy and you're listening to Rear Vision on RN. This week, looking back at 45 years of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. In early May, the ninth review conference of the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, will be held in New York. Delegates from over 150 countries will be attending. And with the recent announcement of a potential agreement about Iran's nuclear program, there might be some cause for optimism about containing the spread of nuclear weapons.
World powers and Iran have agreed on a framework to evaluate Iran's nuclear capabilities in exchange for the softening of Western-imposed sanctions. US President Barack Obama says the deal shows that diplomacy prevailed.
Because of our diplomatic efforts, the world stood with us. And we were joined at the negotiating table by the world's major powers.
A successful agreement on controlling Iran's nuclear ambitions would definitely boost the mood in New York, because all the pre-conference chatter is very pessimistic. Unlike 2010, when Rear Vision last looked at the NPT and progress in nuclear disarmament.
Since the 2010 conference, there's been a series of conferences, three conferences, about the humanitarian effects of nuclear weapons. And the last one of these conferences in Vienna, Austria, drew 150, 160 countries. And part of that movement is talking about the nuclear weapons countries just are not serious about disarmament. And we need to pass a treaty that outlaws nuclear weapons, that there is no legitimate use for a nuclear weapon. You know, they're just too indiscriminate. You know, you can't use them in a military way that won't kill hundreds of thousands of people.
John Mecklen, editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Earlier this year, the Bulletin moved the hands of their famous clock warning of the dangers of nuclear war back to 3 minutes to midnight. Many NPT supporters are worried that the treaty is under severe strain. There are several issues to be concerned about. Arms modernisation, the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons, containment of weapons-grade fissile material, a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, and the future of the Cold War strategic concept of deterrence. And not to be forgotten, the fear of other countries or even terrorist groups wanting to join the nuclear club.
Mankind must put an end to war. Or war will put an end to mankind.
The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 shook the feeling of complacency about nuclear weapons. It's now known that luck, rather than good management, averted catastrophe. The NPT was first signed in London, Moscow and Washington on July 1, 1968. While there was a strong global mood for disarmament, not all countries were convinced about the intentions of the nuclear club. Interestingly, one country that is now a strong supporter of disarmament was initially suspicious. Here's Australia's Prime Minister, John Gorton, just 10 days before the signing of the NPT at the National Press Club in Canberra.
Mr. Prime Minister, 2 months ago our delegate at the United Nations spoke on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and he expressed a lot of strong reservations about this treaty.
We in Australia indicated that we agreed with the principle of such a treaty, but wanted to be sure before we signed it that it was an effective treaty, and that we would be requiring the answers to a lot of questions.
Liberal Prime Minister John Gorton on June the 20th, 1968. There's a link to the press conference on the Rear Vision website. Australian political scientist Christine Leia has recently published a book on early Australian interest in acquiring a nuclear deterrent. According to Leia, Gorton was reluctant to sign the treaty because of his personal preference not to exclude forever Australia as a non-nuclear weapons state. Via Skype from Yale University, where she's now based, Christine Leia.
Great Britain was withdrawing from the region at this time, and so was the United States. The Australian officials were constantly asking, look, Washington, can you please tell us under what circumstances you would use nuclear weapons in our defense and in defense of our forces in Southeast Asia? And the Americans were constantly rebuffing officials in Canberra, saying, look, guys, you don't need to know the details, just trust us. And so Australian officials, well, we can't trust the Americans. And actually, both the father of Professor Hugh White and the father of Kim Beazley were both advocating for Australia to get its own nuclear deterrent, which I thought was interesting.
The NPT came into force 45 years ago, on the 5th of March 1970. It wasn't fully ratified by Australia until 1973 under the Whitlam government. In early 1963, President Kennedy warned that if something wasn't done to slow down the nuclear arms race, 15 or even 20 nations could get the bomb by 1975. A few months later, JFK gave a speech that laid the foundations for the eventual treaty that was signed in 1968.
First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control.
The NPT treaty allowed the dangerous forces of nuclear weapons to be controlled, and Kennedy's pessimistic prediction didn't come to pass. But there are still plenty of contentious issues on the agenda at the New York conference. So, what is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, John Mecklen.
It's an agreement between the five then acknowledged nuclear powers with most of the rest of the countries of the world, what they call the non-nuclear powers. In that agreement, the treaty, the non-nuclear powers agreed not to seek nuclear weapons. The nuclear powers agreed to help them obtain and use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And as part of the same deal, the nuclear powers agreed that they would disarm. That agreement was not in some specific time frame, how fast, in what ways, but a part of the bargain was that the nuclear powers would disarm.
What about that concept of deterrence? I mean, where did that figure in the discussions towards signing the treaty?
This treaty was really negotiated and sought, you know, as it became clear that without some kind of agreement, nuclear weapons would proliferate around the world. And the basic theory of deterrence of what has, you know, by some accounts, kept the world from thermonuclear war over these last 70 years is a balance of power. And it's primarily a balance between Russia or the Soviet Union in the past and the United States, and to some degree now China. But it was thought, well, if more and more and more countries start getting nuclear weapons, that balancing act will be impossible to control.
A lot of the debate about the NPT since it came into force has been about how serious the nuclear club are about disarmament. The P5 are France, the United Kingdom, the United States, Russia and China. Jim Doyle is an independent consultant on nuclear security. The NPT, he says, has been a success, but after 45 years, there are questions about the commitment to disarmament. On the phone from his home in New Mexico, Jim Doyle.
It's under strain because the initial bargains contained in the treaty really have not been honored by the major parties. And that, of course, is the Article 6 obligation on the part of the weapon states to pursue the elimination of nuclear weapons in good faith, and the Article 1, I believe it's Article 1, which is the states not to acquire nuclear weapons. So the non-nuclear weapon states pretty much have held up their end of the bargain, although there have been compliance cases. There have been states that have signed the treaty not in good faith. Iraq, Libya, Iran, perhaps, although that's certainly a matter of debate whether Iran has had substantial violations of the treaty or not. North Korea was a member at one time of the treaty and violated it and then withdrew. So there have been compliance issues on the part of states that promised not to acquire nuclear weapons, but there have also been a lot of disappointment on the progress or lack of progress made by the states possessing weapons to eliminate.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, 'cause we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, 'cause the balance of power's maintained that way. Who's next?
Even with the relative success of the NPT, satirist Tom Lehrer's mid-60s song about who might get the bomb still resonates today. The pressure back then was on Russia and the US to act. Author of The Global History of the Nuclear Arms Race, Professor Joseph Siracusa.
And it was a very simple narrative. It was compelling. The agreement was a bargain between the nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots, whereby the latter promises not to build nuclear weapons, while the former promises to provide nuclear energy and technology. Now, the key there, and you don't see it in most textbooks, is that while the nuclear powers were providing nuclear energy technology to the non-nuclear states, that was free of research and development costs. So nations that didn't have enough money to think about a nuclear grid could get all that information and materials for free. And that was a very, very compelling story.
Mr. President, Your Excellencies, honored senators and members of Congress, distinguished guests, the treaty we're signing today is the result of efforts extending back to the dawn of the atomic age. At that time, when the United States was the sole possessor of nuclear weapons, we felt that even one nuclear power was one too many. Beginning with the Baruch Plan in 1946, we have persisted in our efforts to curb the spread of nuclear weapons. This treaty is not the work of any one country, but is in fact the product of all nations which shared our concerns over the danger of nuclear proliferation.
The opening speech to the signing by President Johnson of the NPT Treaty, July 1, 1968. And it was then open for signature for the rest of the world. Professor of International Diplomacy at RMIT in Melbourne, Joseph Siracusa.
Today we have nuclear powers who don't have the rule book with them, so that's what makes it very difficult. But for the NPT to survive today and to remain relevant, you know, progress has to be made in other areas, and most of the world has chosen controlling nuclear materials and hopefully in reducing the number of nuclear weapons through various negotiations between the what we now call the P5 or the nuclear powers. And so there are a lot of things to be done, and people are saying they're looking at the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty. We still don't have ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And the superpowers, they've disarmed, but they still possess enough weapons between the two of them to blow the Earth to kingdom come. So we got that other problem.
Australian political scientist Christine Leah is a specialist in nuclear strategy. She'll be visiting New York to attend one of the many meetings associated with the NPT Review Conference. Unlike other analysts, she believes that an essential part of the NPT's success isn't only disarmament, but also having a credible nuclear deterrent. Via Skype from Yale University, Christine Leah.
There's always been arguments about how successful and durable the NPT is. Since the end of the Cold War, for example, when India and Pakistan acquired nuclear weapons and then North Korea, and currently we're unsure about what Iran is doing. On the one hand, you can say overall the number of treaty breaches have been relatively limited. And so there hasn't been a sort of proliferation cascade, either in the Middle East or in Northeast Asia. The other significant development has been a significant reduction in the arsenals of both the US and Russia, down from tens of thousands of deployed warheads to a few thousand each. But then you can easily say, well, that was because of a much more benign security environment that allowed this, not because the great powers wanted to act in accordance with the spirit of the NPT per se. But overall, it seems to be an effective treaty if you're measuring its robustness and strength by the limited number of nuclear weapon states.
Christine Leyer's view is that a world with significantly fewer nuclear weapons exposes what she calls conventional weapons imbalances between countries. That's a dangerous idea, says nuclear security consultant Jim Doyle. The longer we rely on nuclear weapons, he says, the statistical probability of disaster goes up. Hence the importance of adhering to agreements made at the NPT conference. On the phone from his home in New Mexico, Jim Doyle.
We have this document that the final document of the 2010 review conference set in motion an action plan. And even prior to that, there was a 13 step that the member states all agreed to in terms of tracking progress towards Article 6 and other actions that have been followed since the 2010 review conference. And the progress made towards disarmament on the part of the weapon states really is pretty poor. And this can be expressed in terms of simply in numbers, where the weapon states, the United States and Russia, will say, well, look, we're down by 70% since the Cold War. But that's really not reflective of where the weapons still figure in the national security strategy of the countries, and the fact that they have thousands of nuclear weapons available for prompt use. And the other thing is that there hasn't been very much progress on transparency of the five weapon states that are members of the treaty in terms of declaring to the international community what they have, how many weapons, what's been dismantled, what disposition of the dismantled weapons, and so on.
This is Rear Vision on RN, online by podcast through iTunes and by mobile on the ABC Radio app. Today we're looking at key issues for the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as it prepares for its ninth review conference in New York in early May. Reviewing what happened in 2010 and what hasn't happened since will be on the agenda in New York. John Mecklen, editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, believed that the most contentious issue at this year's conference will be arms modernization. While the number of nuclear warheads are declining, the remaining weapons are being upgraded and made more deadly.
So the United States has embarked on a modernization plan that involves a new penetrating bomber, new intercontinental ballistic missiles, new missile submarines. This is all scheduled to cost a really fantastic amount of money. It's over 30 years. It's something like $1 trillion is the estimate I've seen. But this is not to look only at the United States or to criticize the United States. As this is going on, Russia is essentially doing the same thing. It's much less transparent about its nuclear weapons, but it is clearly upgrading all three legs of its triad. China is involved in numerous nuclear modernization projects, including both on long-range missiles, cruise missiles, submarines, and India and Pakistan are both engaged in sort of, you know, just all-out forward moving on all their nuclear fronts. So there really is this worldwide, we need to technologically upgrade, A, because the systems we have are old, but also sort of an undercurrent is, and B, because everybody else is. We will fall behind if we don't have bombers with the right amount of stealth to be able to penetrate air defenses. We won't be able to accomplish some missions that a president will need, so we need a new bomber. It's that kind of thinking, and that's mostly what this weapons modernization craze is about.
One of the notable speeches of President Obama's presidency was given in Prague in 2009. In many ways, it echoed the sentiments of President Kennedy's speech on nuclear disarmament in June 1963. Here's a brief extract from Obama's Prague speech.
Some argue that the spread of these weapons cannot be stopped, cannot be checked, that we are destined to live in a world where more nations and more people possess the ultimate tools of destruction. Such fatalism is a deadly adversary. For if we believe that the spread of nuclear weapons is inevitable, then in some way we are admitting to ourselves that the use of nuclear weapons is inevitable.
The Prague speech was regarded by many as kick-starting the mood of optimism among supporters of total disarmament, a mood which continued at the 2010 NPT review conference. But Obama also stated in that same speech that, quote, as long as these weapons exist, the United States will maintain a safe, secure, and effective arsenal to deter any adversary, end quote. For analysts like Christine Leah, those words could be interpreted as supporting the arms modernization push, which many critics see as against the spirit of the NPT.
For those reductions to take place, you have to ensure that the warheads you do maintain and their delivery systems are robust and functioning, which certainly makes sense currently, but becomes even more important as you go below current start levels. The smaller your arsenal, you want to make sure that the ones you do have are going to work when you want to threaten to be able to use them. So for me, it makes sense.
You don't see it kind of undermining the spirit of the treaty or, in a sense, against that mood of the people trying to, I suppose, limit the dangers of nuclear weapons?
No, not at all. Because for me, deterrence is the name of the game. Your policies should have a strategic goal. What is a strategic goal? The strategic goal is deterrence. Modernization doesn't necessarily imply an increasing interest in wanting to use nuclear weapons, you know, either for coercion or deterrence or for military purposes. It's simply about retaining a deterrent capability as you go to lower numbers. For me, it doesn't undermine the spirit of the NPT because, again, the tension between deterrence and disarmament. But it's more about not letting the U.S. nuclear arsenal be deteriorated before we are ready to go to lower numbers.
Christine Leah, author of Australia and the Bomb, now based at Yale University. According to Jim Doyle, deterrence shouldn't be the driving force for maintaining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Now, when the United States and Russia will come to the treaty and they'll say, we've reduced our stockpiles by this amount. But then you look at their long-range plans over the next 20, 30, and 40 years to completely modernize and refurbish and recapitalize the whole nuclear weapon production infrastructure and many of the delivery vehicles themselves. So it's clear that there's no intention of really considering an exit from the nuclear deterrent system. And that is the ultimate objective of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to achieve a point in international relations where nuclear energy is used exclusively for civilian purposes and not military purposes.
The power of emotions, moral persuasion, and even rational argument hasn't had much impact persuading nations who have nuclear weapons to get rid of them. That's the view of Professor Joseph Siracusa, author of A Global History of the Nuclear Arms Race. On the eve of the 9th conference of the 45-year-old, relatively successful NPT, the mood is particularly depressing.
I've got to know some of the delegates who've been to these conferences, and you're quite right. In the beginning, when they started to have the reviews, they were very confident about things, and now they're very depressed. You know, they all sit around with their Carnegie Guide to International Peace under their arms, and the have-nots, particularly those who think seriously about things, they're still angry with the P5, that is, with the nations who will not reduce their nuclear weapons. I know that is the clause says they will reduce them, but the British can't go back any further than they have, nor the French. The Americans and the Russians don't want to go beyond 1,550 strategic nuclear weapons, and these conferences have never discussed the elephant in the room. Tactical nuclear weapons have never been discussed at any conference. And tactical nuclear weapons are all Hiroshima size. They sit on a shelf. The Russians today have 3,000. The Americans have about 500, 180 of them in Europe. So they're trying to stretch the treaty to cover these other kinds of weapons. Now, the smaller powers, they gather together in geographical or ideological groups to carve out positions for themselves to force the larger powers to give up more and more weapons. And so these tend to be like most UN-type things. They tend to go along geographical and ideological and political fault lines. And so everybody has a very nice time in these places, but they don't get much done. And they're very discouraged about the one that's coming up because it's a very pessimistic time for these people.
So the NPT review conference this year there's already a big discussion around it. Will it be now a tragedy, a farce, or maybe unexpected success? There is many problems that can make this conference either one of those three. I'm more of a pessimist, but maybe our panelists will have more optimistic things to say on that. The first question that I would like to ask all of you would be, from your point of view, what could be the most contentious topic to the NPT review conference?
You'll see at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference that there will be a lot of crosstalk and a lot of what seems like very esoteric doing nothing. But that's because it's a very difficult problem. The question really comes down to, is the approach going to be incremental, as has been sort of the U.S. and Russian view, moving slowly and carefully and trying to bring weapons numbers down? Or are the non-nuclear countries going to push for something faster than that and perhaps even push toward a treaty that outlaws nuclear weapons?
That's John Mecklin, editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. We also heard Joseph Siracusa, professor of international diplomacy at RMIT in Melbourne, Christine Layer, who is a postdoctoral associate in grand strategy at Yale University, and finally, Jim Doyle, nuclear security consultant and non-resident associate of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University.
There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry.
Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for today's Rear Vision. And this song, We'll All Go Together When We Go, is performed by satirist Tom Lehrer. The recording is from 1960. I'm Stan Correy. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. And we will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.